This Catholic order, the Servants of the Paraclete, ran what they called a treatment center in Jemez Springs. And so from the late 1940s until the 90s or so, it accepted priests accused of sexual misconduct, among other things, for evaluation and treatment. Can you just give us a sense of what happened there? So let's just start with one example, a priest named George Weisenborn. What's his story?
Father Weisenborn was a priest from the East Coast, the D.C. area, who was caught on multiple occasions sexually abusing young boys by police. They would come to his order back east and say, hey, you know, you need to do something about this, rather than prosecuting Father Weisenborn, which is a whole other problem. But Father Weisenborn's order intended to kick him out of the priesthood. The backup plan was to send him to Jemez Springs, to the Servants of the Paraclete. When they reached out to the servants as to whether or not they would accept Father Weisenborn, the servants said, yeah, we will. We would like a $10,000 donation to come along with him, but we'll take him. And so they did. The intent was for him to remain with the order indefinitely. But within a few years, Father Weisenborn, in the process of what's called supply ministry, was assigned to New Mexico parishes, including St. Francis Xavier Parish on South Broadway here in Albuquerque. And he abused a number of children there.
And just to clarify, the Servants of the Paraclete is a separate entity from the Archdiocese of Santa Fe.
Prior to 1971, the Servants of the Paraclete were under the authority of the Archdiocese of Santa Fe. After 1971, the Servants of the Paraclete became an independent order. They sort of called their own shots from there on out. But they're in the geographic jurisdiction of the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, and the Archbishop of Santa Fe, you know, ultimately has a lot of pull in his geographic jurisdiction.
Priests that were accused of sexual misconduct in any part of the U.S. could be sent to Jemez Springs. They'd be at this retreat center undergoing psychological evaluation, having group therapy, individual therapy, things like that, for a few months or longer. Would they have had any contact with children during that time period of treatment in New Mexico?
Well, the servants lost a lot of files over the years. So we don't know exactly what the day-to-day life of a paraclete priest looked like. We do know priests who were sent to the Servants of the Paraclete were not kept under lock and key. They did have freedom to travel, freedom to go home to visit family and things of that nature, but also, you know, freedom to go down to Albuquerque for the weekend and things like that. So certainly there were times where priests who were sent to the Servants of the Paraclete in Jemez Springs were in contact with children during their treatment duration.
You, with the law offices of Brad Hall in Albuquerque, actually filed a complaint against the Archdiocese this spring in which you named dozens of accused priests who had been treated at the Servants of the Paraclete. How did the Archdiocese respond to that?
The Archdiocese basically declined to respond to that, I think is probably the fairest way to characterize their response. Our allegations were listed in a complaint filed on behalf of one of our clients. We named all of these priests specifically and asked the Archdiocese to either admit or deny that these priests had been accused of sexual misconduct, that these priests had spent time in New Mexico. And the Archdiocese across the board stated that they lacked sufficient information to either admit or deny either of those things about any of those priests. And so that's where things stand today. The information, you know, that we were drawing on is all information in the public domain. So with these priests, you could go out and Google any one of them and find either convictions in court records or newspaper stories discussing allegations or convictions. So this information was not hard to find.
Currently, the Archdiocese acknowledges these 78 priests, but you're saying that you think the Archdiocese should acknowledge any and all priests accused of sexually abusing kids anywhere who then spent time within the boundaries of the Archdiocese of Santa Fe. Is that right?
That's correct.
Why? Explain a little more.
The logic of putting together a list of credibly accused priests in New Mexico is that if you knew where these guys were and you knew when they were in particular places, you might be able to reach out to potential victims. And that's the logic behind the Archdiocese releasing the assignment histories of the priests that it did include on its list. So whether or not a priest is quote-unquote working in New Mexico, if a priest is living in New Mexico and is in contact with children in New Mexico, the risk is the same. Of course, I'm talking about a priest who's credibly accused of childhood sexual abuse. So the distinction, in my opinion, is an artificial one designed to minimize the scope of that list. I don't know if the archdiocese knows or not which of those priests were working in New Mexico, right? The priests that were at the Servants of the Paraclete frequently engaged in supply ministry. So I don't know, and I don't know if the archdiocese knows, which is scary, which of those additional priests actually did spend time in New Mexico parishes ministering to New Mexico families and interacting with New Mexican children. If they know and they aren't telling, that's a problem. And if they don't know, then that's also a problem, right? Because what we're trying to do is risk assessment and sort of pick up the pieces in all of this and try to help people who may have been harmed. The first task there, if you're doing that kind of triage, is assessing the scope of the damage accurately.
Last month, a Pennsylvania grand jury report that drew national attention included several priests accused of horrible sexual abuse who were then sent to New Mexico for treatment. There's at least 10 by my count. And at least one, the report says, admitted to the indecent touching of a boy while he was in Jemez Springs. How would you characterize the extent to which New Mexico has been a sort of dumping ground for problem priests?
I mean, I think that's, you know, the one thing that everybody kind of agrees on at this point, unfortunately. It's not a controversial thing to say that New Mexico is a dumping ground for toxic priests any more than it's controversial to say that it's a dumping ground for toxic chemicals elsewhere. I mean, New Mexico has been used as the dumping ground for lots of things for a long time, and that is tragic.
Does this Pennsylvania grand jury report give you reason to think, is it making you think about the scope of this problem differently than before?
Maybe not me. I think we've known just from doing discovery and seeing the sheer number of personnel files that were implicated in all this, that this was a national and international problem, right, for a while. I think the cover-up, right, which I think is the thing that's shocking people the most about the Pennsylvania grand jury report, played out in dioceses across the country. The grand jury report discusses a playbook for concealing abuse. And as I was reading the list of bullet points for what the plays were, it's just nodding along saying, yep, yep, that's how it happened. You know, that's how a crisis gets brushed under the rug. And so I don't think I'm surprised at the scope of what was revealed. I will say that I think we have not captured the full scope of what actually happened yet. I don't think the Pennsylvania grand jury report does. I don't think that any of the work we've done here has revealed the full scope of that cover-up or that crisis. So there's more work left to do in that regard.
As an attorney who's represented many victims or survivors of priest abuse, what kind of response would you most like to see from the archdiocese next?
I think the archdiocese should become an open book to the people of New Mexico. I think that there was a deception that was radical in its scale, and I think the way that you rebuild the breach of trust that results from that is with radical transparency and saying, here we are, here are our records, here are our personnel files. We've redacted the names of victims, right, because we think that's private, but here are the personnel files of perpetrators. Here is all of our correspondence. Here's what we knew, and here's what we didn't know. If you have full disclosure to the people who are scrutinizing you, then you can start to rebuild trust. People don't believe the church's apologies are genuine right now because they still sense that so much is being withheld. So I think that the way you overcome that and start to rebuild trust is by having that kind of radical transparency.
New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas has recently said he's been in communication with the Pennsylvania Attorney General. If the New Mexico Attorney General does launch a similar investigation, what do you make of that, that this is happening now and not a year ago when the Archdiocese published their list or in 2015 when Hector Balderas took office?
Somebody always has to go first, you know, and there was a grand jury report out of the Diocese of Altoona-Johnston back in 2016. You know, the Pennsylvania grand jury reports that we're talking about now here in 2018 aren't, this isn't the first time this has happened, but it's big, right? It's large scale, huge investigation. You know, I think that the report ended up being almost four times the size of the Altoona-Johnston report. And I think it's just sometimes you have to lead by example. I think that's what the Attorney General and the Pennsylvania grand jury did. I can't fault, you know, Mr. Balderas for not being the first one to think of doing this. And, I know he has a lot on his plate. New Mexico has a lot of problems. But now, at this moment, when the iron's hot, I think it's really, really crucial that Mr. Balderas impanel a grand jury and let them investigate the history of this issue in New Mexico, because it's a huge part of our state's history, and I think it has not been given nearly the time or the attention it deserves. And I think our state has suffered as a result of that. I think we're still seeing the public health fallout of widespread childhood sexual abuse through the decades. So whether that's drugs, whether that's domestic violence, whether that's just depression or suicide, it plays out over time. You know, it's a huge scar. And in some ways, it's not even a scar because the wound hasn't healed. So, you know, we're calling on Mr. Balderas to impanel a grand jury, to back that grand jury with investigative power and let them dig into this issue. I think it's crucial. And I think if we don't do it now, it sort of gets lost in the shuffle.
Levi Monagle, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.